The Oxford English Dictionary is truly a marvelous and indispensable resource. No library, public or private, dare be without it. But few of us think of it as anything more than a scholarly dictionary, largely because even fewer of us know anything about its history, a history that led us at Talking History to title our program for this week, The Professor and the Madman. That's the subject of Eileen Dugan's talk with Simon Winchester.
Could you imagine writing a dictionary? What words would you choose to include? What spellings? What definitions? What pronunciations? Although today we take our American Heritage Dictionary or our Webster's for granted, there was a time not long ago when dictionaries were not so common for the English language. One late Victorian effort to capture the rich vocabulary of English was the Oxford English Dictionary, or the OED. It was very arduous work, requiring decades of research and scores of contributors to track and define over 400,000 words. Who would ever guess that beneath the genteel exterior of this most scholarly of projects lay an incredible tale of murder and madness? With us today to discuss the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary is the noted author, journalist, and broadcaster, Mr. Simon Winchester. In the course of his career, Mr. Winchester has covered the world for The Guardian, London's Sunday Times, National Geographic, and Condé Nast Traveler. His most recent book is The Professor and the Madman, A Tale of Murder, Insanity, and the Making of the Oxford English Dictionary. Welcome, Mr. Winchester.
Well, thank you.
Briefly, what is the Oxford English Dictionary?
Well, briefly is not really a word you can use to describe the OED as it's known, because it is so vast. It currently, the second edition, is 20 volumes. It was published in 1989, the latest edition. And since then, there have been three volumes of called Oxford New Editions, because the word, the language, is constantly growing. But the first edition, what we're really talking about, which took 70 years in the making, was a relatively modest 12 volumes that encompassed about 415,000 words and took an enormous staff 7 decades to create.
And what is so special about the Oxford English Dictionary in terms of its content?
Well, the basic thing is that everything is there, that every single word in the English language and every meaning, every shade of sense of every word is there, with an elegant and perfectly accurate definition, and with a long etymology, and with a long, everything about the pronunciation and the phonetic language of each word. But most important of all, and what marks the OED out from essentially every other dictionary in the language and in the world, is that for every word, there's, as it were, a biography of each word made up of scores and scores of illustrative quotations that have been drawn from the published literature down the centuries. So in other words, the first appearance of a word like dog, which was in about 830 AD, is there in the dictionary. And then every different spelling, as the word changed from D-O-G-G-E to D-O-G-G and then to the current spelling D-O-G, that would have been in about 900 and 1100 when it changed to the shorter spellings. And each century shows a new meaning, a new shade of meaning of the word dog. All of those quotations that illustrate these twists and turns of the individual words of the language are there, and that's why the dictionary is so huge, because it's got all of these thousands, millions of quotations showing the development, the biography of every single word in the language.
A book about the creation of the OED may strike some people as an unusual undertaking. How did you first get involved in this story?
Well, I was fairly interested in lexicography sort of on the side, and I was reading a rather remarkable book called Chasing the Sun, A History of Dictionary Making by a man called Jonathan Green. I was reading it actually in the bath about 18 months ago, just before breakfast, and there was a footnote in it which said, readers will be familiar with the extraordinary story of Dr. W.C. Minor, the American lunatic and murderer, who was such an enormous contributor to the Oxford English Dictionary. I remember sitting bolt upright in the bath, rather like Archimedes, and dripping wet, saying to myself, well, I know nothing of this story. And I had the phone beside the bath, and I telephoned a lexicographer friend of mine in Oxford, in England, and she said, yes, she knew about W.C. Minor. In fact, she had written an academic paper about him about 20 years before. When she was doing the research, she had been allowed into Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum, which is where this mad fellow was incarcerated for 38 years, and where he did his work on the dictionary, and she had seen the great big medical files on him but had never been allowed to look in them. And she said to me, if I could somehow get permission to look in the files, then there was probably rather a good story to be told.
What was Dr. Miner's background?
He was from an extremely good New England family. The Miners went originally to Connecticut in the middle or the early part of the 17th century and were part of the founding families, if you like, of this New England state. W.C. Miner himself was born in Ceylon, the island which we now call Sri Lanka. His parents, part of this sort of Connecticut aristocracy, were missionaries, and he was brought up on the island of Ceylon and grew to know and speak very well the local languages, Sinhalese and Tamil and Hindi, then came back to America when his parents became rather concerned that he was over keen on the young, naked native girls he met on the island, and they thought he should come back to New England in rather more respectable circumstances, and they packed him off back to high school in New Haven. Then he went to Yale, and then he became a surgeon, and basically he was sent off to fight in the American Civil War and was ordered to brand the cheek of a deserter during one of the battles with the letter D. And this event, obviously horrible for the chap who was the deserter, but horrible too for this young man, W.C. Miner. And he went mad, basically, to cut a very long story short. And he was sent by his parents to London to try and get over this madness. But he didn't at all. He murdered someone. He shot a man dead on the streets of Lambeth in South London and was sent off to this lunatic asylum called Broadmoor for the rest of his life.
Did this insanity plague him for the rest of his life?
It most certainly did. And it was a particularly florid kind of insanity, which today we'd call paranoid schizophrenia, I think. Especially during the night, he would think that succubi, evil female spirits, would rise up from under the floorboards and transport him bodily all the way to Constantinople, where he'd be forced to commit unnatural sexual acts with women and children and animals and things. He dreamt that people were forcing metal biscuits into his mouth covered with poison, that they were hammering spikes into his legs. So he was very, very mad indeed at night. But during the daytime, he was a gentle, courteous, and very, very scholarly man. And it was during the daylight hours that he did this incredible work on the dictionary.
Now, at the same time that he's going through this experience, the OED is in its early stages. And how was it assembled? How did they plan to bring it about?
That was quite a task, really, for the lexicographers who came to the project in the middle of the 19th century, 1857 to be precise. They knew they had to assemble this vast corpus of quotations, but at first, although their eventual solution seems obvious to us now, they didn't really know how to do it. And then they hit upon the idea of calling for volunteers, of making the whole dictionary project, in essence, a very democratic project that would allow any English-speaking or reading person anywhere in the world, be it England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, or North America, the United States, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, anyone who read books, basically, in the English language would be invited. And so they sent off a brochure, which they sent out to all bookshops and all libraries all over the English-speaking world, in the hope that anyone that read, either bought a book or borrowed a book, would see this appeal for volunteers, as they called it. And that's what essentially happened to W.C. Miner, because he was in his cell in Broadmoor. He had formed a relationship with the widow of the man that he had murdered, a bizarre thing, but nonetheless the prison authorities let this woman in to see him. She would bring him books, which he craved to put in this library he was creating in his prison cell. And in one of the packages of books that she brought in about early 1880, he found this piece of paper, this call for volunteers. And he sat right down and said, this is the way that I can redeem myself. I've done something dreadful with my life, but I'm going to spend the rest of my years in this lunatic asylum. Well, at least I can improve the shining hour by writing for this dictionary. And that's what he did.
Now, you mentioned that he had books in his cell. How was he able to do that? How was he able to have a library?
Once again, it's an indication of the extraordinarily genial liberality of the prison authorities back then. W.C. Miner was rather a wealthy man. He had came from a good Connecticut family, as I've said. He had his American Army pension. And he was allowed, as a result of this, he rather awed, I think, the administration of the prison who gave him two cells, and in one of the cells, and I've been to them several times in the course of the research, in one of the cells he had a library. All of his books came over from America, and he bought lots more that the widow would bring him from the bookshops of London. And in the other room, the other cell, he would have a fireplace, and he'd have bourbon, which was sent in by the American ambassador to London. He'd do his painting. He was a rather good watercolorist. He'd play the flute. And he even had a patient who was rather less mad than himself, acting as a manservant. So it was actually a rather congenial sort of life in a way, except he could never, ever leave.
And how did he get involved with the man in charge of the OED project?
What happened was that he responded to this appeal for volunteers and wrote a letter saying, "My name's W.C. Minor. I have a lot of time on my hands, and I love books, so let me read for you." And he signed the letter, W.C. Minor, Crowthorne, Berkshire. Crowthorne being the name of the village, and Berkshire the county, where Broadmoor Asylum was located. This letter went to James Murray at 78 Banbury Road in Oxford, only about 40 miles away. And Murray was, of course, very pleased. Here was an educated man with lots of time on his hands and lots of books, writing from a village only 40 miles away, offering to do work. And so Murray wrote back and said, "Splendid idea." And for the next 20 years, they corresponded back and forth, with Murray never, or at least so the myth has it, it's not entirely true, never suspecting that W.C. Minor of Crowthorne, Berkshire, was actually William Chester Minor of Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum, who was a lunatic and a murderer and an American. It never occurred to him. It wasn't for many, many years in which W.C. Minor would rather mysteriously never come to any of the celebrations that were staged whenever they finished a volume of the dictionary. Nonetheless, Murray remained in total ignorance until he went down to meet him one day, and then the secret was out.
Was Minor ever cured of his problems?
Not at all. It got worse as he became older. In fact, something rather dreadful happened in 1902 when he mutilated himself terribly badly, and his physical health started to go downhill. And it was then that James Murray, who by now was called Sir James Murray and was very much a force in England, petitioned the British government for him to be released and sent back to America. You know, he was 4,000 miles from his family, and James Murray felt rather sorry for him. And I think one of the most moving documents I found in the files was the British government in 1910 saying that this rather doddery and still mentally ill old man could go back to America, and the papers allowing this was signed by the young Home Secretary of the day, Winston Churchill. Well, he was put on a boat, and he clutched in his hand the last, or the first, six volumes of the OED, which he had been so instrumental in helping create. He was readmitted when he got to America to St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, the hospital where John Hinckley is today, the attempted assassin of Ronald Reagan. And he remained there very ill, still not working on the dictionary at all, until 1920, when he was now in his 80s. And then he was removed to a home in Hartford, Connecticut, for the elderly and sane, and he died there in 1921.
In the end, what was Minor's contribution to the OED?
It's a little complicated to explain the precision with which he worked, but suffice to say that because he did work in such a methodical, orderly, and organized way, he was able to offer quotations which went into the dictionary in huge numbers. And Murray was able to say that probably all of the books, all of the words of the 18th and 19th century were illustrated by quotes from W.C. Minor, such that the dictionary simply couldn't have been completed had it not been for the work of this remarkable man. So his contribution to the dictionary is absolutely inestimable. He was a wonderful, wonderful helpmeet to the dictionary editors.
Now, reading this book, I must admit that every time something would happen in Minor's life, I would say, oh no, not something else. And on the surface, it seems like a great tragedy. But is it a tragedy as it first appears?
I don't think so. I think it's a rather ennobling story, really, that despite all these terrible things that happened to batter this poor man, he consciously, perhaps, semi-unconsciously too, worked on this incredibly noble project. And I say semi-unconsciously because I don't think he was totally aware of the size, the majestic scale of the dictionary that was being created in the outside world. And he, of course, never lived long enough to see it. He died in 1921. The dictionary was first produced in 1928. But the dictionary is, it's obviously James Murray's memorial, but it stands also as W.C. Minor's memorial. And what a memorial to have. I mean, the greatest dictionary in the English language, arguably the greatest single book in the English language, because it's the fount of everything that we use in everything we say and write today. The fact that W.C. Minor, this poor old man, is so intimately associated with it makes the saga, I think, a noble and touching and rather poignant one, and not a sad one at all.
Well, thank you, Mr. Winchester.
Thanks very much.
Hey, we've been talking with Mr. Simon Winchester, author of The Professor and the Madman, A Tale of Murder, Insanity, and the Making of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Simon Winchester's not the only person who's written a history of the Oxford English Dictionary. So too has John Wilinski, and we have asked Professor Wilinski to add his thoughts on the OED. John Wilinski is Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of Empire of Words, The Reign of the OED, published by Princeton University Press in 1994. Wilinski has titled his op-ed for today, The Most Authoritative Dictionary in the English Language, only more so, as I would have it.
As one who has written a critical history of the Oxford English Dictionary, I suffered the slings of its great defenders as they rose up from the cozy common rooms of the British Review establishment to tell me in one voice, back right off with your political correctness, the OED's authority is unimpeachable. Truth is, I couldn't agree more. Certainly my research on the OED convinced me that it really is, as has long been claimed, the most authoritative dictionary in the English language. And the more I studied it, the more I wanted nothing more than to bolster that authority, to strengthen and extend its representative claims to the language. Remember, it began as the overambitious project of amateurs, driven by their love of the language and their own scholarly interests. It was led by a schoolteacher, and schoolteaching's my first calling. The OED was a grandly public project, originally spurned by the great universities, dependent on common readers, sending in examples of how words had been used over 1,000 years of literary, legal, historical, religious, and scientific writing in English. The OED's authority that I want to bolster is based on the linguistic authority of a democracy. It is an authority based on the use of the language by individual writers, each allowed to say in the OED itself, through its brief citation of their work included at the end of a definition. You can see on whose authority the OED's definition is based, and you can then judge that definition for yourself. It speaks to a democracy of writers and readers, as if the language was truly in our hands. The OED is but our servant, offering readers a tasty sampling of what writers have been making of the English language since roughly 800 AD. What then is my complaint, my concern? Well, there are plenty of opportunities for the OED to improve that authoritative claim. First, consider its historical coverage of the language. Just as our idea of democracy has expanded since the early days of the OED in the last century to include the unpropertied, the unwhite, and the unmen, so we need to recognize that the OED underrepresented the contributions of women and working-class writers who wrote far more than the OED has credited them in its record of the language. The OED could also improve its reflection of English as a world language. I found in my work a few years ago that India's flourishing English language publishing industry accounted for but 1% of the OED's reading program in search of new words and citations. The OED needs to move beyond the linguistic catchment area of the New York-London publishing axis and thereby extend its authoritative claims to represent the life of the English language on this planet. But having said that, I recognize that as an educator, I can do my share to improve the democratic basis of the OED's authority. I can help students appreciate how the OED reflects and represents usage rather than dictates it. I can invite students to draw on and challenge the authority of writers represented there through their own creative and critical use of the language. This is, after all, the very principle of the great dictionary's authority, and I certainly want to be counted among those who critically support it.
You've been listening to John Walensky, Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology at the University of British Columbia and the author of Empire of Words, The Reign of the OED. Say the word. Shine.